back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice-weekly podcast for the people who make fine art with needle and thread. And this week, someone I've known online for a long time in one way or another, Ilka Cochran of Mabel Figworthy's Fancies. Hi, Ilka.
Hello.
This is quite strange because we encountered each other on the Cross Stitch Forum, I believe it was, right?
It was, yes.
Yes.
Many, many years ago.
Yes. And you're the one who got me to try Hardanger.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Was that my fault?
No, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Because you had a couple of years, you did a monthly design, little, 4x4 designs.
That's right. I did a stitch along.
Yes.
Twice so far. And they were usually just small bits of Hardanger. Partly because I'm a small project builder myself. And so even when I do a cell, I keep it nice and small. And I think participated in the first one in 2013.
I did. I did the first one, and I think I did most of those, and then I have all the patterns for the second series, and I think I did one or two, but then my interest went off in other directions, so I never did. But I kept them all because I have the cloth and the thread. I mean, I bought all the stuff, so it's in the pile with a bunch of other stuff, but I intend to do them because they're fun. They're simple little things, and the way you built them up in terms of complication, adding a new stitch or a new design each time was really educational. And I learned a lot from the few that I did. And got rather comfortable doing that kind of stitching.
That's very much the idea that I had with the SAL and any of the workshops and so on, is to get people into something that they might not have tried before, and sort of ease them into it in little steps. So
yes, yeah,
thank
no,
you.
It was
glad that worked.
Oh, it did. It was wonderful. And once you get over that hump of cutting the canvas or cutting the cloth, that's
quite.
That's still the freak out part, but
it is, yes.
Yeah. But yeah, a lot of fun doing that. And what I should do is I should haul those out and take them on the road with me because they're a perfect size for stitching on the road. And
they're quite good little travel projects. Yes.
Yes. So I should do that. Yep. So that was, yeah. So that, the cross stitch forum, and that was one of those where I was fairly active, and then I got to a point where forums were just sucking up too much of my time, so I kind of faded away out of that and actually haven't been back. I should go back and see if my account's even alive.
Oh, it probably is.
Yeah.
We get people looking in from time to time who've been fairly inactive for several years, and they just come back. I'm still on there.
Yeah.
It's a very nice, friendly sort of place to put your stitching and to get a bit of feedback and to talk to people who also enjoy stitching, which, you know, for quite a few of us, there might not be somebody in your immediate family or circle of friends who really gets what you're doing. It's nice to have a circle of friendly people to talk to about that.
Yeah, and that group, of course, a lot of people end up with Facebook and FlossTube in the cross stitch community. But that cross-stitch forum, I remember a really active group of very friendly, very helpful people. Yeah, it's a very nice organization. I ought to get back there. Yes. Well, as soon as I find a spare minute between midnight and 3 in the morning, I'll do that.
Ooh. Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah.
But just as you picked Hardanger up because of me, I really got into Hardanger because of one of the members there, one of the very active members. Her forum name is Sarinda. She's a very, very sort of fabric-y sort of name. And she was the one who did bits of Hardanger and showed that in between her cross stitch. And I thought, oh, that looked like fun. I'd been doing cross stitch for some time and thinking, yeah, okay, well, I'd like to try other things as well. And that looked like something I could do, because it was still count it work. It's still just sort of counting the number of holes and putting your stitches in and according to a chart. So it was not quite, I was going to say, uncharted territory, it was something that was challenging, but not too far outside my comfort zone. So I am eternally grateful to Surinder, who was instrumental in my taking that up. And in a sense, because of that, was instrumental in Mabel's fancies springing up.
So that was the origin of that. Cause that's the most, that was, I remember one of the most interesting things is your business name, Mabel Figworthy's Fancies. And the immediate conclusion is that your name is Mabel Figworthy, but it's not.
It isn't. No, yeah. No. Mabel Figworthy is a character in a song by Flanders and Swann. Some of your listeners may remember Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud, the hippopotamus and so on. And they were quite big in the 50s and 60s. I happen to be a fan because of a forum, again, based around them. I actually met my husband and moved to England. So when I had to pick a forum name for the cross-stitch forum and some other places, I didn't want to use my own name because I was slightly iffy about plastering that all over the internet too much. And so I came up with Mabel Figworthy. So when I decided to set up the little business, it made sense to keep using that name. And I sort of stretched it a bit with the fancies and asked the person who is now sort of in charge of the legacy of Flanders and Swann legally, and said, is it all right if I do that? Because I suppose the name is copyright. And he said, yeah, go ahead with my blessing. And so there you go. There is Mabel. And by now, people do call me Mabel, and I'm sort of taking it as my second name, really.
Yeah, because I remember on the cross stitch forum that it was not uncommon for people to just address you as Mabel. And
that's right, yes. Yeah. And I'm perfectly happy with that. And it's especially when I'm teaching English speaking people, they might find it easier to say Mabel than Ilka. So it works both ways.
Now you're Dutch, right?
I am. Yes.
Yes. So family, because you live in England, so family over there.
Yep, all my family's over there. I'm the only one here. I think a cousin of mine taught at Cambridge for a bit, but as far as I know, I'm the only one here at the moment. So I do go back and see my family, but most of the time it's just me here and a bit of internet connection with Facebook and emails and so on.
Right.
And the
phone.
How
did you get started stitching? Did you learn traditional way from mother or grandmother?
No, not really. My mother was an extremely good seamstress who mostly out of sheer necessity made quite a lot of my clothes when I was little and later did it more for the fun of it. And I still have some dresses that she made. But she was definitely not an embroiderer. And my grandmother was a great knitter, but again, not an embroiderer. And I absolutely hated needlework of any kind when I was younger. When I went to primary school, we used to have two classes a week, and in Dutch they were known as handwerk and handarbeid, and they both translate as handwork. But one of them is sort of knitting and crochet and embroidery and so on, and the other one is more crafty, like with metal and wood and making cardboard houses and what have you. And the boys had 2 hours of that, but the girls had 1 hour of that and 1 hour of the textile stuff.
Oh.
And this was the 70s. And I absolutely loathed all the textile stuff. And there was a boy in my class who actually wanted to do the textile stuff, but he wasn't allowed to because he was a boy. So we went to see the principal and said, can we swap? Can I do 2 hours of the crafty stuff? And can he do an hour of the textile stuff? But you know, as I say, 70s, this was not exactly smiled upon. So
right.
I did learn to knit and to crochet and do a bit of stitching, and much good has it done me. And the moment I could drop it, I dropped it like a hot potato, and then didn't do anything with it for some time. And I lived in a tower block, which had a sort of inner hall that the eight doors of that particular floor came out on. And we all got on really well. I started living there when I was three, and so I called most of the people their aunt and uncle. And one of them was a retired housekeeper for a Catholic priest, and she did lots of needlework, but she got slightly confused and she couldn't really do the work anymore. And eventually she said, would you like to try and would you like to have the materials? And I thought, well, yeah, why not? So I had a go. But by then she wasn't really capable of teaching me anymore. So I was just given this enormous amount of material and thread and left to get on with it. And fortunately at that point, we had a really, really good needlework shop within walking distance of where I lived. And they were extremely helpful in letting me try different bits of fabric and so on. So that's how I got into cross stitch. And I can't remember where it is now. I think it probably got lost in the move to England. But for years, I kept my my very first bit of cross stitch, because not hampered by any knowledge or anything, I just picked what I liked, and I found a kit with a white cat curled around a satin stitch letter I. So I picked that, did it, and it contains one of my basic mistakes ever, and I'm not even talking about crosses going every which way, but I would use every thread down to the last centimeter if I could. And most of the time that's not a problem, but on a white cat, after a few years, all those little ends that my fingers had held in the needle and which I then used to stitch with went yellow. Uh-huh. So this was a sort of yellow streaked white cat around the initial. So I'm now much more profligate with my threads. When I get towards the end, I just ditch it. And I think, you know, it's a couple of pennies missed out there. But yeah. Hey.
And there's that constant reminder. Take it to the end and down the road.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Don't do that again.
Yeah, that's one of the things about white in general is extra care up front. Yeah.
Yes, this might well be why my hardanger is generally a bit more colorful than the traditional stuff.
Yeah. So you're a rare one in that you got handed a stash right out of the gate. Most people have to accumulate that.
I know. I went with whatever I was given. Which turned out to be things that I didn't really work with later on. So she had a lot of 11 count Ida cloth.
Oh.
14 count is much more usual. So quite a bit of my first things were quite big, really. Were quite big. And then when I got that cat kit, that was on even weave, and I'd never even heard of the difference between Ida cloth and even weave.
Uh-huh.
So I just went for it, which was rather nice. Coming to this hobby in a completely untrammeled way and just doing whatever felt okay. I never had the idea that I could not do this or I should not do that, and that was quite liberating, I think. Well, it can't be liberating because I didn't feel shackled in the first place, but you know what I mean. It's yes. It's quite a nice free way of approaching it. And it's one of the things that I try to do whenever I teach is to say, what you're making is your project and you decide what it's going to be and you decide what it's going to be like. If I show you how to do a stitch and you find that there's another way which works better for you and it looks exactly the same, go ahead. That's fine. I mean, people around the world have been developing stitches and working things out, and they do it in different ways. And there are very few things in embroidery which have to be done in a particular way, which is one of the things I like about it. I mean, within hardanger, for example, you have these things called cluster blocks, which are five satin stitches together. And you have to do them the long way round. So you go from down to up and so on, so that the back of the cluster block looks pretty much the same as the front. You have to do it like that. You can't do it in the thread saving way of sort of zigzagging.
Right.
Because if you do that, the moment you cut, the whole thing falls to pieces. But honestly, I think that's one of the very, very few things that I found in embroidery where you actually have to do something a certain way. There might be ways which are more economical or better or more acceptable, because there is sometimes a bit of a sort of embroidery police about.
Yes.
Where people say you can't do this or you have to do that. But generally, there's very little that you have to do, which is what I like, and which is one of the things I try to get across whenever I teach. Just enjoy what you're doing and do it in whichever way feels best for you.
Yeah, and you got kind of a special start in that you didn't have all the rules and regs dropped on you by someone else. So because most of us, it takes years and years to break out of the this is the only way, this is the right way to do it, and feel like you can experiment and try things. And so you got it from the other end. That's
I know. It's how I started, and I think quite a boost, and possibly why I kept going with it, because it was very much something that I could decide what to do with. And I'm by nature quite a sort of law-abiding conservative person. And I've once said that freestyle embroidery was as close to anarchy as I was ever likely to get. it's where I can do exactly as I please, and I don't feel bad about it. So stitching is my rebellion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've done some regular surface or freestyle embroidery, and it's a weird sensation, you know. In that, yeah, you can pretty much go where you want and do it how you want, and years and years of being restricted to the grid, and all of a sudden there's no grid. Now what?
Now what do I do? Yes, yeah. It does make some people panic a bit. so you think, I want somebody to tell me what to do here.
Right.
And I'm a member of an embroidery circle. We meet during term time at the local adult education center. And we just, each of us brings our own project, and we stitch and we chat and we have a cup of tea. And occasionally we teach each other. And then mostly doing cross stitch. And they look at some of the things I do and they go, oh, isn't that really, you know, scary to do? Because how do you know where to put the needle? I said, well, do you see the outline here on the fabric, which, you know, is a drawing of a bird or whatever? Yes. I said, well, that's where you put your needle. And in fact, it's a lot easier than cross stitch in that you don't have to count and you don't have to look at a chart. In a sense, if you want to, you can just draw a little outline on the fabric and grab a few colors that you like in threads that you like and get going and do whatever comes up in your mind. So, yes, it's a really nice, relaxed sort of embroidery.
Yes. Yeah, see, that now the kind of embroidery that I've done in the past has always been on some stamp thing with a prerequisite, you know, do this much and this much and, you know, all planned out. And I've been trying some Mary Corbett designs and playing with them and it just poking at them. Cause I keep going back to needlepoint. That's what I really truly
that's
love.
Your thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I keep poking at them and I've got a Trish Burr design working.
Oh,
and, it's just a weird sensation for me, and I really need to sit down and put in 2 or 3 weeks and get over that. Because, I don't find the stitching challenging. It's just a different sensation as
it is,
I do
yes.
it. Yeah.
It's a different approach. I remember you used to do the almost like quilting patterns in needlepoint, didn't you?
Yes, yes.
Mm. Yeah. Yes, they were really good.
Oh, thanks.
And I've still do count it work, and hardanger was very much the first thing I got into after cross stitch. And partly, I suppose, because suddenly I'd left cross stitch, I won't say I left it behind, but I'd added to it. that opened the door for adding lots of other things as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very lucky to have a sister-in-law who lives in London and who doesn't mind me invading her privacy every now and again. And so I used to go to the knitting and stitching show at Alexandra Palace in London, purely just to go there and see what they had and look at all the stands and drool over all the stash. And I used to do some workshops there as well, because the Royal School of Needlework, for some years, did a series of 1 hour and 90 minute workshops to just give you a sort of taster of the various techniques. And within about 2 years, I think I did all eight of them. And and I thought they were a brilliant way of trying out something new without having an initial outlay that, you know, that the mind boggles at. Because you just go there, you pay your whatever it is for the workshop, which I think at that point was something like £12. And you have the tuition, you have all the materials, you have everything that you need. You get to try this. And then if you don't like it, that's it. You've spent £12. It's a lot more by now, but it's still fairly affordable. And that's all. You haven't invested in a complete set of,
right.
I don't know,
yeah,
lacing bobbins or whatever.
Yeah.
You can just try. And so they were a great way for me to find out the things that I did like and the things that I didn't like. And they also they also taught me that you sometimes mustn't take things too seriously. I remember being quite disappointed when I signed up for the silk shading and found that actually it was just done with DMC cottons. It wasn't done with silk at all. And it was just that the technique is known as silk shading.
Right.
You can do it with silk. It's beautiful with silk. But that was cotton, so that was slightly disappointing. But I liked that technique, and I have done some more in it. I also did stump work, and I found that that is just not me. Mm-hmm. All the fiddling with florist wire and beads, thank you. Large wooden beads that were then covered in this, that, or the other to make them look like blackberries or whatever. It was just a bit too fiddly for me. And I think one of the things I like about embroidery is that in essence, it needs very little. It needs a ground and it needs a thread of some sort and it needs a needle and a pair of scissors. But as soon as you got that, you're good to go. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose stump work was just a bit too much external stuff. having said that, I have just bought a kit from Sarah Humphrey for a little stump work butterfly.
Oh, there's a talent. Oh my, that woman. Oh.
Yes. Good, isn't she?
Oh.
And last summer I actually did a 2-day embroidery retreat led by her and Angela Bishop at Coombe Abbey, which is a sort of Tudor type building, which was Opus Anglicanum embroidery. Mm. Which is the medieval English embroidery in silk and gold, and that was absolutely amazing to do. It's not just learning something new, but it's having the time to do stitching and absolutely nothing else, because you don't have to feel guilty about the washing up, because the washing up is back home and you can't do it anyway. And there's 12 other people who are enjoying this just as much as you are, and you've got great tuition. They are just lovely, these sort of retreats. And I sort of try to treat myself to something like that every year, or have done for a few years now. So the year before, I actually booked a one-on-one workshop at the Royal School of Needlework at Hampton Court Palace, which you can do. You can sort of book a tutor for 3 hours. Uh-huh. And this is what I would like to do. Which was absolutely brilliant, because if you go to a predetermined class, there will always be things that you're not that interested in, or you'd like to see more of one particular aspect, which they don't focus on so much. With this, I could say, okay, I would like to do gold work. And what I would really like to do is I'd like to do soft string padding. which I haven't tried before, and I'd like to have somebody show me how to do it. And so for 3 hours, I sat there with my own private tutor overlooking the gardens of Hampton Court Palace, doing gold work and exactly what I wanted to learn, which was absolutely fabulous. So that's really great. That's one tradition I'm going to keep through every year.
Yeah, that would be okay. And nice scenery to boot, yes.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
That's interesting view of retreats, is that you can just go and stitch with people who are stitching, and basically they can't get to you. And all the things, because when you're stitching at home, I really should do this, and I really should do that. And
or the phone rings, right. Or the cat comes and sits on my lap. Which is, you know, nice and relaxing, and she purrs beautifully, but it does make it slightly more difficult. yes, so that's a really nice thing to do. Going back to the little workshops that the Royal School of Needlework did, there lots of other tutors do as well. At Ali Pali, you can do, or at any of the knitting and stitching shows, there's always plenty of workshops to try. And then one year I thought, do you know, there aren't any hardanger workshops. I wonder if they take on tutors, because by then I'd done some teaching at the local adult education center. And I thought, well, I might as well try. So I contacted them and said, do you take on new tutors, and what are your requirements and so on? And they said, well, yes, send us a proposal and pictures and a sample piece, and we'll have a look. And so I sent them the little hardanger mini kit that I devised for beginners.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yeah, that's fine. We'll put you on the program. So that was the first year I taught one course. And then since then, I've been doing 2, 3, 4 workshops most years. So, and not just that, but also shisha embroidery and freestyle.
Yeah.
And all sorts of other things. So it's great fun. I now go as a tutor, which has the added bonus that I get free tickets for all days.
Yes.
And, yeah, so it's great fun because I really, really enjoy the teaching side of it. And I try to do workshops quite a lot. I also offer taster sessions, and they grew out of the Royal School of Needlework ones, because that's, if I have a teaching vision, which sounds very grand, it's
I'm
to
impressed.
Get people to, I know, thank you. Such a visionary me. I try to get people to try things. And one of the great things about teaching the workshops is when I do the hardanger thing, and you have all these people who look at the little sample and they go, oh gosh, I could never do that. And I say, yes, you can. Go on. And we try, and we do the cutting, and they take out the bits of thread that they've just cut, and suddenly they see this lacy thing that they've just made.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, wow, I've done that. And that's a great feeling. And just to have that, give people that opportunity to spend a little bit of money, but not too much. It's affordable for most people. I know, in a sense, it's still a luxury. But it's a small luxury, and you can try these things, and you might start a hobby that you're going to enjoy for the rest of your life, because, you know, barring failing eyesight and very severe arthritis, it's something that you can keep doing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. These taster sessions,
mm-hmm.
Talk about those, because I found that interesting. So it literally is a chance to just dabble, just like you got.
It is, yes. Sometimes I do workshops. I do quite a lot, because we're trying to build a new church building, so we do a lot of fundraising. So I do embroidery workshops for that, for local people. But basically, I offer taster sessions for anywhere between 1 and 12 people, which are 2 hours. You know, it's under £20 a person, depending on what you do. And for 2 hours, we're going to work on one sort of technique. You get all the materials, you get all the necessary instruction, you get something to take away with you, so that if you haven't quite finished it within those 2 hours, you've got all the instructions there. You've got my contact details, so you can give me a call and just have a go and see what you think of it. And most people, even if they at the end they say, well, I won't do that again, they like the idea of having created something and having mm-hmm. done something new. Mm-hmm. And as challenges go, it's a lot more accessible than bungee jumping or things like that.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, it is much more approachable than bungee jumping. Yeah. Well, that's a great thing. And, you know, I think about shops. That would be a way for shops to develop new customers, too, as an outreach thing. It's just a little design, just a simple little thing. Just because I think that, well, I know that for a lot of people, that's what keeps them out of stitching is that fear, that first step. I could never do that. That's so beautiful. I could never deliver that. And quite frankly, yes, you can. Your first one might need a little tweaking here and there, but you can mm-hmm. do it. And
in a sense, the taster sessions are about undermining my own mystique, if I have any such thing. In that, you know, you start out as being the guru who knows everything, and then suddenly at the end of the 2 hour session, they've done something pretty similar themselves. I suppose it's as with all teaching, what you're trying to do is get people to the point where they don't need you.
Yes.
And they can just do their own thing.
Right. Yeah. That's actually success teaching wise. Mm. Yes.
Yep. Oh yes.
Yeah. Yep. They move on. Yes. Yeah.
They do.
And this teaching and design work, when do you start, as you're working your way through stitching, when do you start doing designs and teaching, and then eventually set up this business? Because this has grown quite a bit from what I can tell. I mean, you're offering all manner of things these days.
Yes, it is still very much a sideline. My husband and I have a business providing parts for pre-war Austin Sevens, which is pretty niche in itself. And so that's the main business. And Mabel is very much a sideline. My husband keeps telling me that I ought to go for world domination, but it's just, I want to keep it enjoyable. It started out with me deciding that I wanted something that wasn't out there. And so I designed my own, sometimes in cross stitch, sometimes in hardanger. And I would stitch those purely for my own enjoyment, and then I'd put them on the cross-stitch forum where we shared all sorts of projects. And I would get comments from people saying, oh, gosh, I'd rather like to do that. Would you like to share the pattern, or could I try that? And to begin with, you know, that's just how it went. I would say, oh, yeah, just send me an email. I'll send you the chart. And then I thought, for the past years, I'd been writing websites for all sorts of, well, for our own business and for various car clubs and for our church. And I thought, well, if I can write websites for everybody else, I can write a website for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, and I put the various designs up there very much in a sort of spirit of, I'm going to design whatever I like. I'll put it on there. And if anybody else likes it as well, that's great. And if nobody likes it, that's fine too. So in a sense, because it's not my bread and butter, I have very few constraints as to what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So I just do whatever I feel like, put it on the website. And some of the designs have never been bought by anybody at all. Fine. That's not a problem. And one day somebody might. And others have been bought, you know, a fair few times. And that's very gratifying and encouraging. But on the whole, it is, I used to describe it as a hobby that pays for itself. So mm-hmm. it meant that if I wanted to go to Hampton Court Palace and have 3 hours of goldwork tuition, which is a bit of an outlay, I could do that without feeling guilty about it because, in effect, Mabel covered that.
Right. Right.
If I wanted to splash out on fairly expensive silk threads or gold work materials or whatever, I could do that because Mabel covered it. And that's sort of where I'm at with it at the moment. Once my husband retires, we sell the business, it might go bigger. I don't know. But I rather like it in its present informal style because it doesn't put pressure on me. I'm not very good with pressure. So I like to keep it as relaxed as I possibly can. So I do talks for women's institutes and towns women's guilds and embroidery guilds. And I do the workshops and I keep designing. I have designs published every now and again. So it suits me just fine the way it is.
Yeah, but generally you can feed the meter as you want to. And
yes.
If you want to back off for a couple of months, that's not a problem.
Yeah. I can do that, and if I want to step it up a gear, I can do that as well.
Yeah.
And with the teaching, I'm slightly not hampered, limited, I suppose, by the fact that it has to be fairly local. I don't drive. And at the adult education center where I did most of my teaching here, I found that people really liked the introduction sessions. So I would have a 5-week course, and in each of the 5 weeks, basically I'd be doing a taster session and do a different technique. And those were very popular, and I might very well do one again one of these years. But if I then try to offer a course which was more detailed, so, you know, advanced hardanger or advanced freestyle or whatever, that tended to draw 4 or 5 hardcore people, but not enough to make it viable for the college to put it on.
Right.
So, so there, when I teach, I would teach very much just for beginners and to get them into that, which in a sense suits me fine, but it would be nice to sometimes do something a bit more advanced. So I'm getting a bit of that opportunity this year. One of the embroidery guilds not too far away from us has asked me to come and do a day class with them.
Oh.
And because they are an embroidery guild, so they all know which end of the needle the thread goes into and so on. And you can get just that a little bit more technical.
Right, right. Hmm. Yeah, you can spread your wings a bit. Yes.
That's right, yes.
So we have to divert because just give us a little taste of your business that you and your husband do. I think it's the most fascinating thing.
Well, my husband has been blessed with 2 grandmothers who both liked vintage cars and an uncle who had one as well. And so he actually learned to drive in an Austin 7 from 1925 when he was 16 or thereabouts. So, and that's the Austin 7 we still have, and he's since built one himself from spare parts, and he's got another one for trials, sort of competitions, with a friend of his. And there's a 1931 Lagonda around as well, which is a family car. So in a sense, Mabel, I suppose, is my fluffy counterpart for the car businesses. But it's it's lovely. There are so many Austin 7s still around worldwide, and we've got customers in America and Japan and what have you, Madagascar, I think. Oddly enough. And I think there's about 12,000 Austin 7s that we know of still about. They are all dating from 1923 to 1939.
Mm.
Quite a few of them still on the road. Quite a few of them now with our back axle parts in them. And so it's fun. You meet a lot of nice people and you go to a lot of nice events, and it's very enjoyable.
And so you are a source for parts as people keep these things on the road?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Interesting. 12,000, so you see, you have a business built on 12,000 worldwide cars.
Yes, yeah. Put like that, it sounds very precarious. But so far, it's paid the mortgage and everything, so we're doing okay.
Yeah, no, that's... Because, well, when you have that kind of a niche, you certainly have a dedicated customer base.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
They aren't going away. They aren't going to move on to a Ford Taurus or something.
But very unlikely.
Yeah.
Although some of them do have other cars in the garage as well. But yeah.
Oh, that's fun. I just think it's neat. Yeah. So, okay. So back to the stitching now. Had to have that moment because I just had to know a little more.
That's quite all right.
Yeah. So, and you know, when I look at your website and what you're doing, you clearly have the same disease I have in that you seem to be willing to try just about any type of stitching. There doesn't seem to be any hesitation on your part. Let's just have at it.
It could just mean that I get easily distracted.
No. We're gonna frame it as you want to explore new countries at all times. That's how we're putting
good.
That.
Good. That's a good way of putting it. Yes. So started with cross stitch, went on to Hardanger, did some black work, did some Assisi, which is basically cross stitch, but you leave the you stitch the background and you leave the motif unstitched. Then I did some Shisha embroidery, which is sort of Indian mirror embroidery.
Let's talk about that because I've seen it done.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen the results, and it can be beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But all I can ever think of is fingerprints on the little mirror pieces. You know what I mean?
Depending on what you do, they're really too small to worry about that very much.
Okay.
It doesn't show up that much. And what's nice about it is that it's in its original form, it's quite a folky sort of embroidery. So if you look at original Shisha embroideries, they're very rarely very regular, and even if the pattern is sort of symmetrical, you will still find differences on the left and the right where the curve is just slightly different or the color is slightly different. And so it's quite a free sort of embroidery, and just the idea of working with these little mirrors and what I haven't tried yet but do want to try is they work with beetle wings. They're not really wings. They're the elytra, hard covering of the wings.
Right, yes.
Mm-hmm. Of certain beetles. And I felt a little bit iffy about that when I first saw them because I thought, oh, my goodness, I hope they don't kill them or something. I know. Very, very girly.
I don't think there's a serious shortage of beetles in general. So we're probably
true. But even so, I wouldn't like them killed just so that I could do my embroidery. But it turns out they shed them a bit like snake skins.
Yes.
So and then you just sort of pick them up and use them for your embroidery, and they are, I suppose, underlyingly they're black, but they are either sort of bluey green with a shimmer or orangey green with a shimmer. And they get used as well as mirrors. And that's absolutely fascinating to look at because it changes whichever angle you look at it from, which is lovely, a bit like oil on water. So that's one of the things I definitely like to try. And the nice thing about Shisha work is that you can make it as big or as small as you like. And one of the things you commented on when we discussed this earlier is that most of my stuff is small. I don't do really big things. And if I was going to come at this from a negative point of view, again, I'd say I'm sort of instant gratification girl. I honestly haven't got the patience for really, really big projects. On the cross stitch forum, there are people who do these heaven and earth designs, which half a million teeny weeny little cross stitches, and they take years, unless you're Vanessa, who seems to do them in about a month. I'm in awe, but
I'm in awe of anybody who tackles one of those things.
The sheer idea of working on the same project for 3 years is it's just not me. And I found this over the years. I've tried some larger projects. There were a few stitch-alongs, which I thought I would like. There was one with a sort of Celtic tapestry design, which is absolutely beautiful. But I got I think, about a tenth of the way, and I thought, this is never going to get finished. And at that point, you need to think, well, am I going to feel horribly guilty about this and about the waste of materials and so on? And am I going to force myself for the next year or so to do something I don't really enjoy? Or am I just going to cut my losses? And I'm very much in the cut your losses camp, in that, you know, some of the material you will be able to salvage, you will be able to do something else with it, the threads you will be able to use for something else. This is meant to be our hobby and it's meant to be enjoyable. If, for whatever reason, you've picked up something that you really, really don't enjoy, I don't see much reason in, or much virtue, really, in trying to keep it going. So at some point, I sort of looked at what I'd done so far and what I'd enjoyed and what I designed, what sort of came naturally to me. And that was always fairly small stuff. So I have now come to terms with the fact that I'm a small project girl. And I leave the big stuff to other people who do it very, very well.
Yeah, no, I think I see, as I watch the projects that people work, I think I could safely say that there is a trend in general, particularly in cross-stitch, towards smaller projects. Just overall, and away from the larger ones, and a lot of that is, I think, younger people want not instant but very short term gratification. There's that satisfaction of finishing, of making progress, and those Heaven and Earth design people who will stitch for 2 months and finish a page, boy, you gotta have some drive behind that to keep going.
It would have to be something that really seriously appealed to me. Yeah. and even then, I can safely say I'm very unlikely to ever start one of those, let alone finish it.
I never will, because I know darn well it'll never get finished. So just,
quite.
Yeah. But it's an interesting dynamic, because I really think that we're seeing that trend towards smaller things, because I think in general that it fits and appeals to our lifestyles of, I've got an hour here and I can accomplish something.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see also the approach that people have to having more than one project on the go. And without going all ageist and so on, I think on the cross stitch forum and in the stitching groups that I'm a member of, where I, even at 48, I tend to be the youth element. it's very much a sort of, well, when you start something, you finish it and you stick with it and you do one thing at a time. And I had that slight feeling of, gosh, is it really very bad to have three or four things on the go at the same time?
No.
No, I know. I've shed the guilt. I'm completely free now. And in fact, I posted something recently, because Mary Corbett, whose blog I read and I admire her greatly. She's definitely one of my inspirations. And she posted something about bad stitching habits. And I don't know whether she had one. I think she mentioned something about having lots of things on the go. And I thought, let me just count what I've got on the go at the moment. And it turns out at the moment, I've got four things actually in progress. I've got three more things hooped up. I've got three things in the design stage. And I've got two kits from other people that I've sort of got set up to work on. And I really enjoy it. I can pick up whatever I like. And if I don't feel like doing the Sarah Humphrey Cruel Bird that I'm doing at the moment, I put that down and I do a little flower, or I work on my own project for... which is a sort of wedding commemoration for my eldest son, and who I sincerely hope is not listening to this, but he's very unlikely to, so that's okay. So it's lovely. I can, because sometimes I feel like something very small, sometimes I feel like something counted, sometimes I feel like something really colourful or not, and I can just pick up whatever I like and enjoy it. And because it's, I don't get a lot of stitching time in the daytime. I do sometimes in the over the weekends, but mostly it's evening after our evening meal. So not before sort of 8 o'clock. it's not that much time, and I want to enjoy the time that I spend on it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I have no qualms about having multiple projects because there are some nights when I feel like doing needlepoint and really focusing on sophisticated stitches, and then there's other nights where I just want to make a few X's, and so yep, out comes the cross stitch, and we'll make some X's. And,
absolutely.
And to have, or sometimes I think even subconsciously, the colors in this project just feel like I feel today, so I'm going to use those.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And no, I think everybody should have more than one project going. Why not?
if that's what they enjoy. Yes. And what you said about the colors, it was one of the things I really like about this hobby is that you have all the different threads, and I probably have more threads than I will ever use up. And sometimes I have dry periods where I think, I really don't feel like stitching. I don't want to pick up my stitching. I don't want to design anything. I just rearrange my threads.
Mm.
And I stroke the silks because they're lovely and soft and they're shiny and they're beautiful. And at first I thought, you are an absolute idiot. What on earth are you doing? And then I thought, well, it's not that much different from somebody rearranging a stamp collection and thinking, right, ooh, isn't that nice? I've practically got all of France's collection, or I've got the whole of Madagascar's collection except for that one. In a sense, it's, besides being things that we can actually use, which you can't do with your stamp collection, it's just the fun of collecting, I think, is an additional bonus, really.
Oh, yeah, and I think you could easily find people in the stitching hobby who, when you get right down to it, really are just collectors. That they love buying the things and putting them together and assembling colors. And yep, if you sat down and said, all right, what have you stitched and what have you accomplished in the past 3 years? You know, it probably isn't all that much, but they find it's just a great deal of fun to
a lot of satisfaction.
Sure. And what's wrong with that? And
exactly. Yes, they've got an acronym for it, SABLE, which is stash acquisition beyond life expectancy.
Yes.
and that's probably me, but I do use quite a lot of it as well, fortunately. And sometimes just having the threads leads to a design. I have designs that I looked at colors and thought, yeah, I'm going to design something with those colors because I really like them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing what you can get your inspiration from. I mean, one of the Hardanger pieces that I did called Spice Islands is literally based on spices. I was looking at my spice rack and I saw the paprika and cinnamon and turmeric and coriander, I think, and thought, don't they look nice together? I wonder what they'd be like in DMC. And so I took the spices and I took my boxes of DMC and got the colors together and thought, yeah, I want to do something with that. So in the end, I did something in those colors, and just as a nod to the spices, some of the Hardanger shapes are clove shaped. So that's where that one came from. And at the moment on my desktop, there are two photographs. One is a medieval carved door from Bolsover Castle, which a friend of mine posted on his Facebook feed, which is such an interesting shape and design. So that may very well become something. And the other is a picture of an enormous rotor from heaven knows what sort of technical thing, mechanical thing, which I photographed when we did the big auto jumble fair at Bewley last September. And we were walking around the stands, and there was this rotor, which has the most amazing sort of curved triangular shape with circles in it. And it's really lovely. So that may well become something. Barrington, the two Barrington designs are both based on ceilings in stately homes.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are based on stories. The resurrection one, which is a dragonfly, is based on a story about it's on the website, but it's a little story sort of trying to explain resurrection and eternal life in the shape of a dragonfly. sometimes it's my faith. I did one based on the fruits of the spirits from Galatians, and some crosses. And it's just anything really, which is the interesting thing about it.
You designer people amaze me. You see things in the strangest of things and this could be a design. Yeah,
it could. Yes. And sometimes it doesn't lead to anything and it just goes in my folder of unused sketches. And sometimes I come back to something after years and think, oh, do you know what? I think I can do something with that. I just need to tweak it here or there. And that's lovely. And so I do keep everything I scribble. And I do keep pretty much everything I stitch as well. And, that's another thing that Mary Corbett actually did write about in her Six Bad Stitching Habits, which was finishing things. And she said there's two types of finishing. There's where you've got a project 90% finished and you just can't get yourself to do that last 10%, which is a shame because it just sort of sits there looking at you accusingly. And then there's the finishing that you do after you finished, if you see what I mean. So once you've got your completed bit of stitching, do you frame it? Do you turn it into a cushion? Do you, whatever? Do you do something with it? And I have boxes full of finished stitchings that are not finished in that sense of the word.
Right.
And one of the ladies in my stitching group, especially, she says, but you ought to do something with it. They're far too pretty just to put in a box. And like Mary Corbett, I have this ready-made excuse. Well, I have to have stitched models for the website. So
yes, yes.
Yeah, so that is their purpose. But in a sense, I've decided that their purpose is for me to enjoy them while I'm stitching them. And my favorite example is if you play golf or you go 10-pin bowling or you go and see a film, you know, you pay your money, you enjoy that activity for 2, 3, 4 hours, and then you go home and nobody asks, so what are you going to do with that round of golf?
Right.
You just enjoyed it. And I think it's because stitching at the end of it has a physical object left. I think that's why people ask that question. But I've sort of decided that if it gets finished as something, and I've got a fair number of thread boxes which have sort of stitched inserts, and some of them are framed and cushions, and I do, blessed be the small projects, I do an awful lot of cards and things like that.
Yeah.
And coasters and what have you. If that happens, that's fine. And if it doesn't, that's fine as well. I have really enjoyed stitching it. I've learned something from it. It's given me pleasure. I've got it in my collection. Sometimes I go back to things that I stitched years ago just to check up on a certain stitch that I did or have it out. And it's a bit like looking through old photographs. It's great fun looking through your old projects. And sometimes, like old photographs, it can be a bit cringeworthy. you think, oh my goodness, why did I ever do that? But most of the time, it's just great fun.
Yeah. So, no, I'm like that. My standard answer when people say, what are you going to do with that? And my standard answer is whatever my wife wants to, because I really don't care.
quite.
I just enjoy the stitching of it. And
that's right, yeah.
And the challenge and the finished product and what I learned from it. And after that, whatever.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah. What is that psychology? Oh, man, we're going to have to wrap up. Darn it. What is that psychology where you get within 10% of the end and you don't finish it?
I don't know. It's one of the things that I don't have a great problem with. I do tend to finish the stitching on projects. So that's not so bad. Occasionally it's because it's something I said I would stitch for somebody else and it's not something that really appeals to me. Sometimes that can just stick. Sometimes it's because there's a problem or a little hitch in it. So the wedding project I was talking about, it's an umbrella with his name and a parasol with her name and the date and a text. And there's something in the parasol that I'm not quite happy with, but I'm not quite sure whether I actually want to unpick the whole thing and do that bit again. So I've been doing everything else that I can do around it until the only thing that's left is that particular bit. And in fact, that is what I am going to tackle, she said determinedly, this weekend, because they got married in September. It's about time that this got finished.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you probably, yeah, a little pressure there, yes.
Yes, yes, definitely before their first anniversary, please. So sometimes perhaps it's that. You look at the thing and you think, there is something about it that nags me and I need to change it and I don't know how to change it or I don't want to change it or it's going to be an extremely big effort to change it. And that can stop people from finishing it. In that case, if you've got a deadline, that can concentrate the mind beautifully.
Yes.
And yep. Sometimes, you know, just leave it for a bit and do other things and come back to it and see whether it's changed. I mean, in fact, I was convinced that I would need to change the lettering on the parasol. And then I've not worked on it for a week or so, except for the simple letters. And looked back on it and thought, well, actually, it's not that bad. I can do a little tweak here or there. And, you know, very likely I won't need to unpick anything. So sometimes it just needs you to step back and not be sort of with your nose against the canvas
right,
or the
right.
material. Step back, leave it for a bit, come back to it fresh, and suddenly you realize that actually it's not nearly so uneven or awful as you thought it was while you were sort of focusing on about 2 square centimeters
right. of it. Right. Yeah, we often forget that the viewing distance is not the distance that we see it at. And many of the perceived flaws or actual flaws just go away from 5 feet distance. Yes,
they do. And also, don't forget that when we are stitching something, we know exactly what it is meant to look like
yes.
from the chart or the pattern. Other people don't know the chart or the pattern, and they haven't got a clue. One other thing that I do put in practically all my workshops and classes is to say, do not point out mistakes, because 99% certain people won't notice it unless you point it out. So don't go all apologetic about what you've done.
Right.
When somebody looks at it and says, wow, did you do that? That's really good. Let your first answer to that be, why, thank you.
Yep.
I really enjoyed it, rather
yep.
than, well, actually, that bit should have been 2 millimeters to the right, and I used the wrong color for that bit, and, you know, because yeah. that's what a lot of stitchers do, and I do it myself. I need to sort of slap my wrist and remind myself not to do that.
Yep. Yep. No, say thank you. Glad you enjoyed it. You bet.
Absolutely.
Yep. Ilka, we're going to have to wrap this up here.
Okay.
And I have more questions, so that means you have to come back. That's how that works.
Ooh,
yeah.
Right.
So.
Well, I'll be prepared.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for doing this. And
thank you for asking.
Thanks to everybody for listening. And we'll be back on Wednesday.